You're listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 Cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional engineer, professional futurist, and sometimes occasional sessional instructor of future studies at Simon Fraser University. And this is a weekly show that looks at future trends and issues and important items that affect your daily life and will be affecting your life into the future. Welcome to the show. We're continuing our look at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation by Jeffrey E. Garton. Last show, we were looking at the chapter Pax Americana. In the late 1990s and early 2000s, there was presidential arm-twisting of foreign governments to persuade them to award contracts to U.S. firms that were competing abroad with companies Washington alleged were backed by their governments. A quote-unquote war room was established in the Department of Commerce to organize U.S. government help, including financing to hundreds of U.S. companies, big and small, to help them win foreign contracts. None of this was really critical to an economy that was gathering steam from the early 1990s recession, moving from a GDP of $6 trillion to $8 trillion, and about to launch a third industrial revolution fueled by a level of innovation not seen in at least a century. Economics wasn't the point, though. Power politics was. The nation that had just won the Cold War and had emerged with an unprecedented military power was signaling that it would not take a backseat to anyone economically either. Commercial diplomacy would be a major part of U.S. policy. For Washington in the 1993 to 1995 periods, this was a new world order. Most of the top officials in the administration supported this effort for two reasons. First, governments in Europe and Japan had much closer and longer-term ties to their companies than Washington did with the U.S. private sector. The administration and a good deal of corporate America felt disadvantaged, especially when it came to winning big international project bids in developing countries like Saudi Arabia, China, Indonesia, and Brazil, where governments themselves were involved in selecting the winners, were susceptible to the kind of foreign pressure that Europe and Japan typically exerted on behalf of their firms. Second, yielding a big club was good domestic politics, because to the extent that Uncle Sam was seen at home as dealing all it could for the companies abroad, Congress and the public were more relaxed about the administration's efforts to negotiate new trade liberalizing agreements. Still, the approach had its flaws. I was constantly asked by Americans and by foreign officials if the United States, as the only power capable of shepherding the world toward an open economy, we could pursue this type of gunboat economic diplomacy and still be a credible leader. There was no easy answers to that one. Washington's actions grew from a gray area to something less ambiguous when it started to pressure emerging markets to follow U.S. economic policy blueprints. Here, U.S. assertiveness morphed into arrogance. The Clinton administration, and I was definitely one of the culprits, used its leverage, which was growing with the strong U.S. economic recovery and the sudden reemergence of super competitive U.S. firms, to press countries in Asia, Central Europe, and Latin America to open their markets to foreign capital to an extent unseen in over 50 years. The administration pushed hard, as did U.S. firms, for the dismantling of trade and investment barriers around the world. We were asking other countries to make painful transitions well before they had adequate underlying regulatory systems. Kenneth Cortes, then a strategist for Deutsche Bank, described what this meant for a small country like Thailand, for example. Asking it to link itself into the global financial system in this way was the equivalent of hooking up a light bulb to a nuclear reactor whose power kept ebbing and flowing, he told me in February 1997. Washington's overzealous policy contributed heavily to the beginning of the Asian financial crisis. As the Asian countries went into deep recession, moreover, the administration pushed the IMF towards demanding too much austerity, a mistake reminiscent of that made in the early days of the 1930s depression, when President Herbert Hoover tried to balance the budget in the middle of a deteriorating economy. Today, the Asian financial debacle is over. It is inconceivable that has not created latent resentment about U.S. pressure. The crisis, though, should not be seen in isolation from other sources of foreign anxiety about U.S. dominance. A good deal of foreign opinion worries about the world's only superpower becoming too powerful for its own good and that of other countries. It's no wonder that the European Union is visibly striving to be a counterweight to the United States, or that Russia and Germany are talking about new strategic partnerships, or that French officials are calling the United States a hyperpower, or that China rails about U.S. hegemony. It's impossible to pinpoint the moment when America's successes in the 1990s moved from a topic of grudging admiration around the world to a constant source of annoyance at Washington's triumphalism to rationale for mistrust and resistance, wrote David Sanger of the New York Times. Perhaps the clincher was the envy over the Dow's dramatic ascent from a little over 2,000 at the start of the decade to a little over 11,000. Maybe it was the dawning realization that people around the globe were all flickering on the same Windows operating system in the morning on their way to navigating an internet dominated by American innovations and businesses and driven by Intel inside everything. Maybe it was when the United States, in the wake of the Asian economic crisis, began offering tutorials on American-style capitalism and insisting that the world's financial architecture be built to American building codes. But surely, Sanger says, a capstone was the high-tech intervention in Kosovo and the image of those B-2 bombers lazily lifting into the air over Missouri at midday, flying an 11,000-mile, 32-hour mission to drop laser-guided weapons over Belgrade and getting back for dinner the next evening. Perhaps these are straws in the wind, temporary manifestations of frustration that will eventually blow over. But just as likely, they are initial stirrings of counter-movement to U.S. power. After all, no empire has been able to avoid the coalescing of the one aspiring in opposition to it. Of course, Pax Americana is young and could continue for a long time, but CEOs in the United States will have to work towards that end, for it is certainly not preordained. What then should U.S. CEOs do? Because an open world economy works well for the United States, they can begin with measures cited in the previous chapter regarding a more concerted policies to make globalization sustainable. A clearer and broader economic and social agenda, more support for a strong regulatory framework for cyberspace, and more active involvement in the establishment of other international rules and institutions for the global economy. Beyond this, they need to think through an agenda for the U.S. foreign policy, and then, as a group, press U.S. officials to move effectively to keep Americanization a powerful force for a long time. An example of the role that U.S. CEOs could have played but did not was in helping to devise policies and strategies after the Berlin Wall came down and the former Soviet Union collapsed. I had a ringside seat from the Commerce Department, being one link between high-level business leaders and the first Clinton administration. In retrospect, the changes that Washington expected to occur in countries that had either been behind the Iron Curtain or had yet to embrace free markets as Americans understood the term seemed to be unrealistic. It was surprising how little capability the U.S. government had for understanding the political and economic dynamics of the newly liberated nations. U.S. embassies were disproportionately staffed with people who understood Cold War military policies, but not economic affairs. Even fewer who knew the business world. The U.S. business community, with its global reach, its extensive involvement in emerging markets, its powerful research capabilities, its vast intelligence network, actual or potential, should have known better, but it didn't help much at all. There were almost no conversations that I recall in Washington between government and business on the best way to help emerging markets make the transition to capitalism, either than to agree to push ahead as fast as we could, press for market openings on all fronts, and lobby for U.S.-style regulatory institutions. Had U.S. companies construed their role differently, they might have counseled us to go a bit slower and make sure that there was broad, local, political support for economic reforms. Advice from U.S. financial institutions would have been particularly useful in warning against the excesses that were building and about to cause the Asian financial crisis, which spread to Russia and South America. The point is not to apport blame. There is more than enough to go around in business and government, but rather to suggest that CEOs construe their role in the global economy narrowly, despite the fact that they were major players and had a lot of important things to say and do to help build a foundation for a stable global capitalism. Turning to the future, CEOs of U.S. companies have already pressed the U.S. government to reduce one of the great irritants, the tendency of successive Congresses and administrations to levy unilateral economic sanctions. They should not let up on these efforts. Aside from sanctions being relatively ineffective, nothing is more irritating for foreign leaders, CEOs, to understand as well the importance of allowing emerging markets like China and the World Trade Organization. They did a good job of pressing the case, but a test still lies ahead, as China will inevitably have trouble conforming to the elaborate rules of the trade organization. Business leaders will now need help from Washington to steer the fine line between blustery threats and steady pressure for Beijing to make the necessary changes in its behavior. This will surely be a difficult task, at least for the next decade. U.S. CEOs also need to work much harder to create national consensus for trade liberalization generally. They should have worked much harder than they did to help President Clinton win fast-track authority from Congress to negotiate new trade agreements, rather than watch as he lost the battle with enormous damage to the credibility of the United States as a free trader. As noted, polls show substantial skepticism in the U.S. public about the benefits of trade to the U.S. economy, and President Clinton was unsuccessful in getting authority to negotiate major new trade agreements. These problems worry foreign leaders, says Mitsubishi's corporations Minoru Mikahara. Quote, "Of great concern to Japan and other countries is the possibility of protectionism emanating from the U.S. Today, U.S. capitalism is often characterized by self-righteousness and a sense that you can't do anything wrong. Of course, there's always been some of this, but it becomes more serious when the U.S. is so predominantly the leading economy in the world. Any kind of leader has to lead by example, not just by sheer power." Jürgen Schrempf of Daimler Chrysler is also concerned about U.S. protectionism. "There are going to be many concerns about moving ahead with trade liberalization in the U.S., he said. "And remember, this is a situation where unemployment is very low and the U.S. economy has been booming for years. Just put yourself in the situation in which there could be a major downturn." A prime requirement for U.S. foreign policy is to support and expand the new economy on a global basis. The combination of deregulation and entrepreneurship and the enhanced productivity and innovative technology has brought to the United States during the late 1990s and into the new century has fostered the economic freedoms and the social mobility that has always constituted the American dream. To the extent that these conditions can be spread and remain sustained abroad, the United States would win in many ways. There would be more economic growth around the world, more open markets for the U.S. competitive industries. Countries enveloped by the new economy are more likely to value individual liberty and be vibrant democracies. It has always been a tenet of U.S. foreign policy that democracies are less likely to start wars, and so the right economic conditions could also lead to a long peace dividend.
You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, Instructor of Future Studies at Simon Fraser University. We're now going to take a short break and listen to a very important public service announcement.
With thousands of homeless animals entering SPCA shelters each year, pet overpopulation is a serious problem in BC, but it's one you can help prevent. Spay or neuter your companion animal today. From our perspective, every homeless animal on our streets or in our shelters is one too many. For more information on spaying and neutering initiatives, visit the BC SPCA website at www.spca.bc.ca.
Welcome back. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby. And you are listening to Future Talk with your host, Dr. Paul Tenery, professional futurist.
Welcome back. We're looking at the book, The Mind of the CEO, which looks at the future of the corporation, by Jeffrey E. Garton. We're looking at chapter Pax Americana. There are a number of ways that American business leaders could help Washington to export the new economy. First, U.S. companies could accelerate their efforts to help establish more U.S.-style business schools abroad, in alliance with local universities and U.S. MBA programs. Second, U.S. CEOs could work with their governments and international organizations to further narrow the digital divide between haves and have-nots. Third, as James Wolfensohn mentioned to me, multinational corporations could do a lot with their own employees, helping with their formal education and their vocational training, including in all aspects of computer competence. U.S. firms could also devise programs, perhaps in conjunction with the U.S. government, to finance teams of economists, accountants, and financial experts and lawyers to help foreign entities think through the laws and institutions that support new economic activities, including tax and regulatory regimes. To be sure, some elements of these programs are already in train, but it's hard to discern a concerted business strategy to extend America's new economy to other countries. And these efforts must be made in ways that our nations are comfortable supporting. And in contrast to the policies of the mid-1990s, within a time frame that recognizes political and social constraints, as well as the need for certain policy foundations to be in place. Another place where business can help in the promotion of with American culture. There was a time, particularly during the first two decades of the Cold War, that the U.S. government went to great lengths to finance the promotion of U.S. libraries, permanent cultural exhibits, and traveling theater and dance groups abroad. In a world of CNN, MTV, and the Internet, the role of Washington is diminished, of course. Federal support for cultural programs abroad is a pale reflection of what it used to be. Also, the market alone is not enough. Adam Smith's invisible hand will not explain to citizens of other countries what the rule of law is in the United States and why it's so important. It won't promote U.S. history or the kind of culture seen in the public broadcasting system. It won't honestly expose the serious difficulties we have with race or crime in a thoughtful, historical way, and therefore build up U.S. credibility as a social worth respecting for its earnest attempts to deal with its problems in an open way. It certainly won't carry the American message beyond its pop incarnation to the poorer regions of the world. In fact, new generations are rising to power abroad with no memory or experience of the United States as the ultimate defender of democracy in the mid-20th century, and as most generous victor that history has ever seen. If the United States does not find ways to keep alive the history of its extraordinary magnanimity, no one else will. It is a story that can be told through many lenses, but it must be told repeatedly. Otherwise, the power that emanates today from the United States will have no context, or the wrong context, and all of the tendencies for other nations to react negatively will be heightened once more. Bottom line is as follows. If CEOs care about prolonging of the American century, it will take continued hard work. The U.S. government cannot be expected to bear all the expenses, or even most of them, and great U.S. companies ought to be more heavily involved by getting together and helping Washington mount cultural efforts suitable in the post-Cold War era. An example of innovation from the U.S. private sector is the effort being made by Ira Milstein, senior partner of the law firm of Veal, Gottschall, and Manges, who has organized groups of U.S. executives to meet with their counterparts in other countries, mostly emerging markets like Brazil, and to explain in non-dogmatic ways how the U.S. economic system works to provide legal and commercial infrastructure in which companies can flourish. Milstein teaches part-time at Yale on such issues as strategy, leadership, and corporate governance. In addition to his law practice and teaching, he's also involved in the World Bank and the Paris-based Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, helping companies and governments around the world to create the right policies to prosper in a global market. We talked in his corner office, which towers over New York's Central Park, a fitting location for a former chairman of the board of the Central Park Conservancy. Quote, "There are legitimate arguments about who should take the lead in building the right platforms for global markets," he said. "But before you assign roles to the public or private sector, you need to know what the right platform is. I happen to think it's a sensible regulation of securities, antitrust, and so on. Lack of corruption in general, and in particular in judicial systems, transparency, and appropriate corporate governance, all to the end of countries and companies being able to attract global capital to build competitive enterprises, which in turn create jobs and economic welfare. CEOs and their successful enterprises can be the voice which understands and insists on what is needed. They must not be passive bystanders. If they are, it won't happen." In our discussion, Milstein mentioned that he was about to take a trip to Brazil with a group of U.S. executives who represent major investing institutions. Quote, "We're going down there. We'll have seminars, discussions, and different kinds of get-togethers. And hopefully we'll leave on the ground in Brazil a group of local business people who are becoming convinced that if Brazil is to develop, and it will, need to end corruption, to have a better judicial system, and so on. I think the message comes better from an investor group consisting of their peers than it does from the OECD or the World Bank or anyone else that looks like a group of bureaucrats who are coming to give them a lecture. Ultimately, only if local businesses exert pressure on their government will things change, though." Milstein feels that this kind of message, which he's planning to deliver to several other countries, including Russia, will be effective if done with humility. "We need to admit all the mistakes we as Americans have made. And we did. Foreign corporate practices, fraud, and so on. We did it all. Monopoly, minority shareholders. There isn't a mistake we haven't made in the United States as we develop this great system we have." He wants to share his experience and lessons with others so that they won't make the same mistakes as we did. So we will continue this in the next show, so please stay tuned.
You have been listening to Future Talk on CJSF 90.1 FM on your dial, 93.9 cable FM in Burnaby, and Future Talk is a weekly show on important issues that affect you and your future. And this is Dr. Teneri, professional futurist, reminding you that if you're not willing to make the effort to invent your own future, then others will be only too happy to invent it for you. See you next week.
Listening to CJSF Radio, Simon Fraser, 90.1 FM.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizerwitz, and this is Climate Connections. Alaska's Salmon River was once known for its clean, sparkling water. But recently, the river has turned a sickly shade of orange, and scientists say climate change is to blame. As temperatures rise, nearby permafrost, or long frozen ground, is thawing. That's letting water and oxygen seep underground and mix with sulfide minerals, creating sulfuric acid. That acid eats away at rocks and releases metals like aluminum, cadmium, and iron. This contaminates the river and makes it cloudy and discolored.
It's pretty upsetting to see that these areas that we have cherished and tried